Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musicians.
From Los Angeles, we're back.
We're back.
This is Score, the podcast. I'm Kenny Holmes. He's Robert Kraft.
Robert Kraft. Yeah, man. I'm so happy to be back and so excited about this week's episode.
Happy New Year.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope you had a good holiday season.
And very good.
I'm thawing out from a cold winter here in L.A.
I'm thawing out from 2 weeks in the Caribbean. You know, it really takes a while to get back to this chilly 68, 69,
yeah,
70 degree
brutal.
L.A. weather. It's just tough.
So excited to be back doing another episode. We had our little off season from season one, but we wanted to put together this special bonus episode with our guest. You know her from Score, a film music documentary, and from all of the great season one segments, The Inside Track. And she's also the author of Psychology of Music, From Sound to Significance, which we're going to be giving away a copy of her book to one of our listeners today, autographed. She's Dr. Sulan Tan. Just super excited. I got a chance to hang out with her in Cleveland. She came to one of our film festival Q&As, and I had as many questions as the audience. She's so interesting to hear these studies and just a lot of the tricks that filmmakers and composers play on us, and we don't even really realize they're doing it to us. They make us look in certain places. They make us feel certain ways, and she can articulate that in a way like nobody else.
It's really an interesting field that she's on the vanguard of the field that she calls the psychology of film music.
Yeah.
It's not just the psychology of music, which she's certainly an expert in, but she has studied film, and to hear her talk about why certain scores work where they work is just, incredibly enlightening.
Not too many people in the field. She's one of the trailblazers, and she's also a professor at Kalamazoo College who teaches classes on this, which I'm so jealous that I don't live there because I would love to sit in.
I'm thinking of moving.
Yeah, or maybe a little fall.
Road trip.
Spend the fall in Kalamazoo.
It sounds like a song.
Also on today's episode, in honor of our guest, we're going to be calling back our first episode of The Inside Track.
Nice.
One of our favorites, in case you missed when that episode aired, discussing how composers end films with music and how they can leave you hanging or let you feel complete or not sure how to feel. The end, or is it, is the name of the
episode. Yeah, such
a
big decision. It's such a big decision what the last note will be.
And later in the episode as well, we're going to be selecting a few of your questions. We put out a little feeler on Twitter and Instagram asking you to send in your questions. We have selected a few to ask Dr. Tan, and one of you will be winning an autographed copy of
one of
her
you
book.
Will be winning an Oscar.
Yeah, and an Oscar maybe. I don't know. I don't have the authority to give that out. But yeah, she'll be signing and personalizing a book and shipping it your way. So we'll get to your questions. A lot of good questions. Thanks for sending those in. And we can't wait to get to that. Robert, we are smack dab in the middle of awards season. We're coming off Golden Globes weekend. We got the Grammys coming up. We got the Oscars coming up. One of the big headlines while we were away in our hiatus was some of these Oscar flubs in submitting. Solo, of course, scored by John Powell and John Williams, didn't make the submission deadline. I don't know how this happens. I don't know how this happens with John Williams and John Powell's name attached to it. First off, is it a rigorous process to submit for the Oscars for a score? Did someone get fired over this?
I can just tell you that missing this is a little bit like, I don't know what kind of simplicity it is. This submission process is, you know, I'm very grateful and humbled to be a member of the music branch of the Academy for the Oscars. And I also had scores submitted, and so I see it from both sides. There's a form. It's that simple. It is supposed to be filled out by the composer, but the composer, particularly composers of that level and that magnitude, Williams and Powell, two of arguably certainly our biggest composers on the planet, have a lot of representatives who are, the delegation is get everything teed up, they sign it. I mean, it's really, the form is, when did you write it? What, you know, is it in the calendar year of the score? Is it, when was the movie released? These are just academic questions. There's nothing kind of big and emotional about the form. It's a submission form to the Academy. And there's a deadline. Whatever that deadline is, midnight on December 31st or something like that.
I think it's in November.
It might be in November. And, well, I think they got it in by midnight of December 31st. That's clearly the issue because...
New Year's Eve party, right? They sent it in.
Somebody, I mean, I just don't want to be there when you look at the nominations and you're all upset that your film wasn't nominated and you call and say, I wonder why. And somebody says, could you hold, please? Because they've forgotten to submit the form. It's that simple. If you miss a deadline, you miss a deadline, period.
And look, this isn't an indie film. We're talking the GOAT. I mean, Rushmore, John Williams, a John Williams score, which is, I mean, the score is great. The movie didn't do so well, but the score for Solo is great and would no doubt be a contender, at least on a short list. But, I mean, I can't even imagine what John Powell and John Williams thought when they saw that. I mean, this is like a football team forgetting to show up for the Super Bowl.
Right, exactly. Oh, God.
Like, oh, we forgot the bus was leaving. It's Sunday.
We're all asleep. Wait, were we supposed to be in line somewhere? So that's just Murphy's Law, of course. But there were some other disqualifications. I always find those interesting because I used to, I think I've given up trying to figure out a lot of the very, very specific rules of the music branch because they are very specific. They have their reasons. Almost every year there's some kind of argument. This year there were a couple fairly traditional areas that were disqualifiers. Green Book, a wonderful film directed by Pete Farrelly, of the Farrelly brothers, and Other Side of the Wind, which is the Orson Welles story. They were both disqualified because of a very specific rule in the Academy that says the amount of original score has to be 51% to the amount of source music, which obviously cannot be more. So
Let me ask you this. If with the judging, is it really that's like, do they time out?
They do.
And they do the math problem and they say
people with stopwatches. And then there's a big thing. Is this an original piece of music or is this, did you just recut a cue that was originally in the film? Whatever it is, I think it's, of course the Academy's trying to honor the creative craft, C-R-A-F-T, of film composing, so they don't want you to win the best music award for a film that's 15 songs and 12 minutes of music. So, of course,
yeah, Bohemian Rhapsody is not going to be in the running for that.
A lot of movies that are very score heavy, just you don't even think about it.
Do the filmmakers, are they aware of this? Like, if someone hires John Williams for a film, John Williams probably not the best example, but are they making sure that 51% of the film has a score, original score, so they can make sure that this gets a chance? Because sometimes a movie can win only one Oscar and it's for the score.
Yeah.
And that's a big mark for the film.
My experience with filmmakers and music is that they care about, I think we're up to 1,000 things, and then 1,001 is the music and the award. It's just, they want to make the best movie possible. And if they need to put in lots and lots of songs. The hardest part for me on one of these disqualifications, Green Book, is that the music was such a huge achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Bowers is the composer. He played all of Mahershala Ali's piano parts and taught him how to play, so it looked exact. The score is really wonderful, and some of the songs are pre-existing. But they were re-recorded. It's just...
That's got to be such a letdown when that comes out and you go, well, you worked all this way and you're not even in the competition.
Yeah, so I don't know. And it's a fight every year. And
there's one other one too, Mandy, which is Johan Johansson's final score.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a tricky one because this is sort of a new problem.
Yes.
This didn't exist 15 years ago, which is the film was released on VOD streaming before it finished its theatrical requirements. So a lot of films, every film that wants to be qualified for the Oscars, they have to do, I think, what is it, an 8 or 9 day run in a theater 3 times a day in New York and L.A. And there's a bunch of parameters they have to hit. So if this movie comes out on Hulu or iTunes or something like that before it meets those requirements, it's out, right?
Exactly right. I think it's 7 days, and I think it has to be 7 days in a theatrical presentation on a big screen in a movie theater. It might be New York and LA, theaters.
I think it is.
And it has to be by midnight of December 31st.
Correct.
So you can release, as sometimes if you're looking carefully, some movies are released on December 24th in 2 theaters. You go, oh, I really want to see that. I wonder why it was only 2 theaters. Well, they're going to come out again in February with a wide release.
Right.
But they want to be absolutely in contention for some Oscars right now. So they release it and they play it from a Monday to a Monday.
I think they did that with The Post last year. Where it came out for like a week in the end of December just to get into the qualification. And it's like, oh, I missed it. It's already gone. No. It's just they're getting into
obviously,
the qualification.
The danger is you come out for that week and you get bad reviews.
Yeah.
And then you come out again and nobody cares. So you can. It's a very lethal strategy. But of course, this is specific to the fact that, well, if you go to Netflix with the movie first, you exempt yourself from the Academy Awards, even if you put it in theaters. And we're seeing that now. Right now on Netflix, there are a number of pictures that are in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to come out first in a theater somewhere before they went to Netflix if they're interested in awards. And some pictures, you just figure, I don't know if on Mandy.
Yeah, maybe the budget wasn't there to even do a campaign. And
yeah, they just thought, we're just going to make as much money in any place we can. VOD, video on demand, that's what that is, or theatrical. And so let's just get it out there, and if somebody picks us up for an award, wouldn't that be great? And if not, that wasn't our focus.
Well, my condolences to John Powell and John Williams for not getting Solo in the running, because the score was incredible, and Han Solo's theme by John Williams was incredible. And I just, when I saw that headline, I think I texted you and Mash Rader instantly and said, did you see this? Are you kidding me? Oh, man.
I'd like to send condolences also to Chris Bowers, who did Green Book.
Yeah.
And also, of course, Johan Johansson, the fabulous composer. It would have been lovely to hear his name read out at the awards.
Absolutely.
But we're going to have to leave it with reading it out at Score the Podcast.
Well, Robert, I'm so glad to be back with you. Of course, Matt Schrader, who normally was in a huge part of creating this podcast and was running the board all through season one, he's off working on some exciting things.
I know that he's rearranging his sock drawer today.
Yes.
And so we said, hey, man, can you help us? He goes, I got it. First of all,
his priority level was sock drawer.
Yeah. So I understand that.
So he'll be joining us as we come down the line with season two, which
if the socks are finished.
I just dropped that season two.
That's exciting.
We're working on it.
I hope there are a few composers left that we haven't gotten on.
Oh, we've got a list, baby.
Oh, good. Phew.
We are putting together season two as you're listening to this. More details to come. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Score the Podcast.
Oh, it's so exciting to be back. Kenny, we're going to rock.
We're going to rock. And this special bonus episode to kind of kick off the new year and really get your brain working. We've got Dr. Sue Lantan.
Can't wait to hear what she has to say.
Score of Film Music Documentary and season one of Score the Podcast. And she's going to be getting to our questions and your questions. Much more to come. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, Robert Kraft, and I'm inviting you to check us out on Twitter for the latest from the show, giveaways, videos, maybe even a new track from that pop superstar, Jordan Bieber. Check out our handle on Twitter at Score the Podcast. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to our special bonus episode of Score the Podcast. We're so excited for our guest. You've heard her first off on Score, a Film Music Documentary.
Heard and seen her.
All the way from Kalamazoo, Michigan. She's a professor, and also her latest book, Psychology of Music from Sound to Significance, second edition.
And I think she's not only a college professor, but clearly, if we engage by the amount of remarks we got about her performance in our documentary,
yeah,
she may be a movie star.
She is a movie star.
I think so.
Well, when we went to Cleveland for the film festival, Cleveland International Film Festival, she did a Q&A with us, and it was the best Q&A we did of the entire run of Score. And,
would you like to introduce our specific guest?
We would like to welcome in Dr. Sulan Tan. We've been saying her name wrong on the season, but it, apparently you can say it multiple ways. Her family calls her in different ways. So,
yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
Thank you. Hi, Kenny. Hi, Robert. It's really a pleasure to be here on the show. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And this is a special edition of the episode in that you're the first guest coming through FaceTime. We're talking to you from all the way from Michigan because of obviously we like to be in people's studios, but today we're here in Holmes Productions.
Our travel budget has been restricted.
Yes.
So that we can, the idea which we wanted, which is to fly to Kalamazoo and interview you in person, we're going to save for next season.
I don't know if I have a jacket big enough for Kalamazoo.
Well, I'd like to say it's, you know, hello from snowy Michigan, but it's not snowing today. There's no snow on the ground. We live in a kind of a woodsy area, so one of the most beautiful things we sometimes see around this time of year is a blanket of snow and then a whole, like a family of deer crossing our lawn. It's just so gorgeous. But no snow today.
I love the way everything you say sounds like way better than anyone else would say it.
And for a podcast, you just painted a beautiful visual picture. I love that.
I wish I was seeing deer out the window. We got, we got hazy skies and
traffic.
Sulan, again, is a music psychologist and specifies in the study of film music, which is so interesting because you're almost kind of a trailblazer in that not a lot of people have done these studies. There's a small group of you. Am I wrong on that?
Yes, it's actually a small group. It started about 35 years ago that people started looking at film music because, you know, film is so complex, music is so complex. So it's not something that all experimental researchers are really drawn to.
It's so interesting because, of course, it was actually through the documentary that I became aware that it was even a field. I mean, I'm so, as you can imagine, I'm so sensitive to the relationship of picture to sound and story to music and all these things, but I never thought of the academic approach and why I respond the way I do.
Yeah, I think for me, from a personal point of view, it's about the magic. You know, movies bring so much magic to our lives. We kind of live a million lives more than we can because of movies. And then as a researcher, it's the mysteries that draw me in. There's so many mysteries about how music works in film. So it's just, you know, just a rich area of research.
Was there a moment or a film or a score that drew you into this study, or how did you get into this field specifically?
Well, it's interesting. My mother was a piano teacher who taught at home. So when I was in the crib next to her and in playpen, I probably have listened to and overheard 100 different piano lessons, hundreds of piano lessons. And my grandfather, my father's father, actually owned a cinema in Indonesia. And my father is an electrical engineer, and his specialty is loudspeakers and sound systems. And he's put sound systems into cinemas. So it's kind of like, you know, it's mysterious how these early foundations in our lives sometimes echo later in our lives.
Yeah.
So maybe it all came from there.
So you grew up in Indonesia.
I was born in Indonesia, and then I moved to Hong Kong when I was about 4.
So were you watching Hollywood movies in Chinese, or what was your early, you know, introduction to Hollywood film music?
Yeah, actually, I don't speak Chinese. I grew up with Indonesian and Dutch, and I actually learned how to speak English when I went to grade school. had to pass an exam. You had to, you know, if you didn't speak natively, you had to have an interview. And I actually failed my interview for first grade. So, because I didn't know enough English. I was like, you know, welcome to first grade. You've already, you know, you've already failed an exam.
But my first
my first forays actually was through Disney movies. So that's the first kinds of films I remember. I remember going to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I remember going to a lot of Disney movies with my family.
I wonder if you walked out with your family as a toddler and everyone was talking about the story and the dwarfs and Snow White. And he said, you know, there was a queue under Snow White in the second act that I feel. But was there? When did you decide this was an academic pursuit, a real legitimate area of interest, which is this fascinating arena that you're in?
You teach courses at Kalamazoo College on specifically on psychology of film music.
Psychology of music, yes,
or and
I also
music.
Right now I also teach child development courses as well. That's my other area. But I always was interested in composing. So I started composing. I composed for about 9 years. I was very active in that. And I was a music major, so my bachelor's degree is music. And then I went to psychology. And once I was in psychology, I thought, well, I put this together with music. Because I was so interested in composition, I started to study how people engage with music when they're listening. So without anything to do with film. But it was kind of esoteric, so when I went to start teaching, my students couldn't always understand what my research was about. So one day I was thinking, well, you know, I'm doing research where you actually have to have a background in music theory. I want to do something that everybody can kind of get into and understand. And I was standing in our basement where we have a lot of posters of films. So I thought, well, what about film music? It started like that.
It's
well, wonder what people have found out about film music. And it started off like that. And also, because I've always really loved the little extras, you know, 8 or 9 minute of extras on DVDs showing about the composer. I always thought that's the best part of the DVD. Why is it only 8 minutes long? I want 80 minutes, you know? And now you guys have actually given that present. So we have 93 minutes of score, the film music documentary.
And we're able to explain it better with the help of you.
That's actually one of my favorite parts of the movie where they show the goosebumps and what happens. And I find it fascinating. I really do. I think it's an incredible perspective on something that we take for granted.
Do you think that using film music, because you said your students were having trouble connecting to classical music, maybe they didn't grow up with it, they're not comfortable with it, but what is it about the connection between especially the younger people and film music? It's still classical music. It's the same instruments. It's the same setup of an orchestra. But why does that connect with them differently, do you think, with your students?
Well, probably has to do with the power of contextualizing it in a story and the whole ebb and flow of the story, bringing out some of the nuances of the music. I think that would be it. The combination of music, powerful music and powerful scenes, powerful imagery and performances, sort of the magic of those two things together, I think, is probably much more than one of each of those alone.
Are you seeing a growing interest at more and more at, over the years with, you know, social media? There's much more information and all this stuff is way more attainable for young people to be interested in. Are you seeing your classes overflowing? Like, what is the situation in schools for this type of study?
Yeah, psychology of music is growing. When I first started, I was in college and then in graduate school, it wasn't really an established field yet. And now we have societies, we have conferences every year, multiple conferences, international, lots of different places around the world, as well as here in the U.S. as well. And among my students, I get so many students in my classes, not just psychology of music, but just coming up to talk to me about how much they love soundtracks. And it's just wonderful to see, right? It's wonderful to see soundtracks like The Greatest Showman just breaking all sorts of historical records, right?
Yes, I wonder, when you say your students come up and tell you about soundtracks, do composers contact you or come up to you to say, I mean, ideally, would they ever say, could you listen to this and tell me if I'm nailing it the way that I'm intending narratively?
I'm looking for goosebumps here.
Yeah.
How do I?
Is there a chord that I'm missing?
Well,
have
I would
have those conversations.
I don't think I would be able to tell a composer what to do. what composers do actually just absolutely strikes me as awesome. They're able to do something that I cannot understand. And I think I'm going to spend my whole lifetime trying to unravel what they do and how they do what they do. My research is really more descriptive. I find out, you know, why does this scene work? But I don't think it's prescriptive. It's not something that's a formula where, oh, here's the results of the study and this is how I should compose. But yes, I've heard from researchers, from people who are studying composing for film, as well as people in the industry, because of score. And very often I get emails that begin with, I was on a plane, because score is playing on so many airlines. So they'll say, I was on a Delta flight, or I was on the plane
Delta.
The other day. Yeah, and I saw this wonderful movie. And then they'll reach out to me. And I've heard from accompanists, silent film accompanists, who will say, I really appreciated. A lot of them are just so thrilled. There's a film that puts film composers in the spotlight and their talents in the spotlight.
Yeah.
So,
I'm just curious, in a typical Sue Lantan curriculum or curricula, do you actually show picture in your class? Will you show a scene, and that scene from E.T. that we talk about in the movie, or Gladiator, or show something and then take apart the way the music supports the scene?
Yes, and two of my classes, we often do that. So I teach a class. I just get to be so lucky teaching the classes I do because they're so fascinating. One is Psychology of Creativity. And in Psychology of Creativity, we have a module that is looking at sound, not just music. We're looking actually at Foley art, as well as sound effects and also music and how those work together within a scene. We do that also in Psychology of Music as well. And I have to say, last year, my entire creativity, so Psychology of Creativity class, and also some of my Psychology Music, we all went to see Score, a film music documentary together.
Oh, good, we need the money, so that's good. I hope they paid.
Foley, of course, for those listening, Foley is the recording of stage sounds for films.
Correct.
So everything you see on the screen is recorded by a group of people. It's an incredible process. There's videos on YouTube you can check out, but it's a really cool process.
And also, I must say that at Fox, the Foley stage, which was right next to my office, was one of the most fun places to play hooky for me. I would actually go to the building next door. There were two Foley artists, both women, who were really legendary Foley artists, and you'd go into their little room. You couldn't believe it. I'm sure you've seen, you know, pictures, or they had the whole floor was laid out with sand and gravel and water, and they'd splash around, or they'd do footsteps.
It's
sometimes
such a cool
basketballs
process.
Bouncing them or locks. It was really great.
And as you went through in one of the Inside Track episodes, a lot of noises like that are used as score a lot now with the creativity of some of these composers.
I thought the Psychology of Creativity would be reduced to, because of course all of us work at varying degrees with artists and creative artists, musicians and songwriters. The Psychology of Creativity, I always thought, could be reduced to, do you like me? Because that's why often people are so driven to make things, I find. I mean, I'm having spent my life in it, sort of looking for applause and approval and love that they maybe never got, which I know reduces it. But there's an engine in a lot of artists to fill themselves up, and creativity becomes a way of finding approval. I don't know if that enters into your psychology classes.
Yeah, I think psychology and creativity, it's all about expressing oneself. We all want to sort of make a distinctive statement One of the interesting things when I'm teaching my psychology of creativity and psychology of music class, and we talk about film sound, is that after watching so many years of film, they're surprised when I point out to them the ventriloquist effect, an illusion that we have when we're watching film. So I point out to them, for example, that when someone is speaking, the sound isn't coming directly from their lips on the screen. So because in the next scene, the lips might move to another spot. So the sound isn't coming from exactly where the lips are moving. That's an audiovisual illusion. So when I point this out to my students, they're like, wait, what? Oh, of course, the sound isn't coming directly from the lips of Ingrid Bergman, for example, or Humphrey Bogart, because in the next scene, the lips might move somewhere else. But it just looks so convincing to them that it's coming from
there. So you almost your brain has to tell you where to look, which is kind of what goes into the eye tracking.
Exactly.
The study you talked about eye tracking. I wanted to ask you about eye tracking a little bit because we touched on it in score, but you mentioned that most of the time when people are watching a film, the majority of the audience is looking on the same spot on the screen at the same time. Is that something that filmmakers take into account? Do they do things based on those studies, or is it just an interesting thing to point out after the fact? Like, how is that used, do you think, in filmmaking? Is that something that they take account for?
I think in filmmaking, mainly it has to do with the visual, the mise-en-scene, the way that we arrange things on the screen so that the eye is driven to those spots. But I think eye tracking is interesting because it can show us a little bit more about what directors are doing instinctively. Their instincts are so good about where people will look. And so, for example, if we are looking at a scene, we find from eye tracking that most people are very drawn to several things: faces, hands, and text. They're also looking at bright spots within darker scenes, for example. Mm. So we can kind of see where people tend to look visually. But then music can also help you to look where you're supposed to look. So two things. One thing is if the music is doing something very similar to what's happening on the screen, your eye will tend to look there. And that's based, again, back on that ventriloquist effect, that illusion. So usually if, for example, we see a horse across the screen, right? We think, oh, okay, the sounds of the hoofs falling where they're falling, that's where the sound is coming from. So when we see a horse going and we hear sound, we tend to look at where the hoofs are, even though the sound isn't coming from there. The same thing. Yeah, and the same thing when we're hearing something like music going up or music going down, if there's something that's moving along with it, we're more likely to look there. And you can kind of create illusions. So, for example, say you wanted to show a scene where you want the viewer to look at something that's very big, like a dinosaur in the front of the scene, and the dinosaur is moving very slowly. So if you have music that's fitting sort of with that very low bass, slow sound, you're more likely to have viewers looking there. But if, for example, you have in the background, let's just say a little poodle running in the background and you want people to actually look at the poodle, then if you have music that's like very light and playing at the same rhythm as the poodle moving, you're more likely to draw people's eye towards that poodle. So if I want the audience to say, hey, don't look at the poodle back there, because I don't want you to see it until the third or fourth time you see the movie, because that's a clue for the story, we can kind of draw that audience eye away.
That's incredible. I think we had a discussion in Cleveland about this kind of, but that goes back to the ventriloquist effect, is how when we're babies, our attention is first drawn for hearing. So you look to things that you're hearing.
Yeah, actually, my other area is psychology, developmental psychology. So I'm interested in infant development, child development. And we actually have learned that we are able to start hearing. So our auditory system is already functioning about 3 months before we're born. Wow. So about 3 months before you're born, you're already sensitive to sounds that come through to the womb. So any sounds that are a little louder than 60 decibels, which is quite a loud sound, sort of like as loud as music would be playing, you know, like in a pub, for example. That kind of music kind of goes through to the womb, inside the womb. So there are certain sounds.
My both boys to a lot of rock concerts before they were born. I mean, I used to. We would go as a couple, and they kicked, particularly. The oldest one really seemed to like reggae. So
you heard it first. If you have a baby on the way, yes. Get your John Williams album out and put the headphones
on. Put the headphones on your tummy. So interesting.
We're going to take a quick break. Much more to come with Dr. Sulan Tan, who's joining us all the way from Michigan. But first, a little treat. The first episode of the Inside Track, The End or Is It?
The Inside Track with music psychologist Dr. Sulan Tan.
At the end of a musical phrase, music can sound like it's still continuing and has more to say. Or like it has ended. In a study by Thompson, Russo, and Sinclair, they showed that whether the music feels like it has ended or will continue can affect to what degree we feel like a film scene has ended or will continue. Compare the second and third Matrix films, scored by Don Davis. Here's how The Matrix Reloaded ends. And here's the ending of The Matrix Revolutions. One leaves us at a point of high tension musically. The other gives more closure, but still leaves some degree of openness. It's also possible that people read different degrees of closure into the same musical endings. For instance, here's the end of Up with music by Michael Giacchino. A number of research studies suggest that some listeners focus more on what happens to the melody, the high notes you hear in the piano. In that case, the ending is musically quite open. Others are more sensitive to what's happening in the harmony, the low notes you hear in the piano. If that's you, this ending will feel more closed because the last chords return back to the tonic chord or home base. This allows individual viewers to feel different degrees of openness and closure in the music and plays an important part in shaping the way they experience this final scene. Lastly, lack of closure can also be powerful. At the end of Inception, Hans Zimmer's music builds up expectations for a grand musical close. Instead, we come to a quiet ending with the final image of a spinning top and a few soft strains of sound. Picture and sound cut off abruptly. Not only is there no closure musically, there's no closure sonically, as the final tone doesn't fade away naturally. We finish that sound in our minds as we do the meaning of the closing sequence. So in the final scene, the last musical notes are as important as the last visual image. To tune where on that scale of tension and resolution, we're finally left at the end of a film.
Dr. Sulan Tan is a leading researcher in the study of film music and the author of many books, including her latest, Psychology of Music, From Sound to Significance, available now at score-movie.com/podcast.
Hi, this is Tom, Junkie XL. You're listening to Score, the podcast. And now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score, the podcast. We're here joined by Dr. Sulan Tan, who is a professor of psychology in the study of music. And that first block, I mean, that could be the end of the show already. That was so much stuff to take in. I've been really enjoying this.
Super interesting, certainly to musicians, I'm sure, to find out that there's more to what they're doing than just simply putting notes on.
They're messing with us.
Yeah, they are messing with us.
And they know it.
And manipulating us. I thought that ventriloquism aspect that you talked about was very interesting. It makes me think, if directors, when they set up shots, you have somebody in the middle and then you cut to another camera, and obviously the voice travels with the actor. You've just basically taught me something about movie making that I haven't thought about, and I've only seen, I think I'm up to a billion movies, and I've never thought about these things, so thank you.
If you can blow Robert Kraft's mind.
Yes, you did it.
You're killing it.
You did it.
I wanted to ask you about, we did an episode of The Inside Track on season one, talking about marches and waltzes, and this is something, this is an age-old style, back to classical music, but it's still used very much today, and as somebody who wasn't trained in music theory, I mean, just growing up with standard pop culture and TV and music, why does this resonate so much with the average person, even if you're not taught what a march is or a waltz? What is it about that age-old style that's still used today?
I think that really still has to do with the human body being symmetrical. So I talked about that on the segment, but to elucidate a little, because our bodies are symmetrical, the duple time is the most natural way to feel rhythm, because we feel it every time we walk, right? Left, right, left, right. We feel it when we're gesturing. Because we're symmetrical, there's this inbuilt sort of embodied cognition that has to do with two times. And there have been studies that show that even babies respond more sensitively to music that is in two times, so like strong beat, strong weak beat, like that, as opposed to 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And the 1-2-3, 1-2-3 is really the music of leisure. It's the music we dance to rather than what we march to. So there's this, I think, instinctive kind of reaction to the difference between 2 and 3 time.
Our brains just think of dancing. That's just so interesting to me, though, that you don't really have to be taught that. It's just instinctive to know that that's a happier rhythm and you shouldn't feel down. Or if like you said, if Darth Vader's marching in, it's low and it's pounding and it's more boom, boom, boom. You feel like, oh no. Like John Debney said, oh boy, something's not right.
Yeah.
Here.
It's in, so well, much of music is instinctive. It's in the body.
Well, of course, and it's sort of, I mean, this is such an interesting area. It's certainly the basis of a lot of Western music, coming from the drumming of Africa and the rhythmic underpinning of music that comes from Africa into first Europe and then brought over on boats, and really interesting history of the way that European music and African music informs Western music. I'm wondering, though, there's certainly cultures that 2 and 3 are just a part of their music. So when you have, and for those of you that are musicians or non-musicians, actually, 2 and 3 are the two kinds of structure that Sulan's talking about, which is 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, which is a march beat. And 3, as she said, is 1-2-3, 1-2-3, which is a leisure beat. But there's certainly 1-2-3-4-5, 1-2-3-4-5, and other beats and other cultures. So how do you, it's not like in Southeast Asia, or, you know, they're not symmetrical, and we're beats that are often 9 or 7, these odd beats. I'd just be curious to know, is that a sophisticated evolution of what you're talking about? 2, 2 plus 3 is a beat in 7. How do you look at those odd meters?
Yeah, and when we say odd meters, they're only odd relatively speaking, right? In many places in the world, they would not be the odd meters.
Yes.
Those would be the meters that we feel. So I think there's just so many ways that we can craft music. This is just... I've just thought about that too. And so there's so many ways, because really music is organizing sound. We can organize sound in so many ways. In some studies, we found that when people who are raised with Western music hear these complex rhythms, polyrhythms, and complex kinds of rhythms that are based on 5 or 7 or 11, for example, what we tend to do when we hear it is we hear it in 2s and 3s. It tends to migrate. We kind of tidy it up through our ears and our minds in ways that become more familiar to us. So, yes, we have so much to learn from music from all over the world. I'm so glad that soundtracks are becoming more and more diverse. We are drawing from more different kinds of traditions of music, because we have so much to learn, not just from rhythm, but different kinds of harmonies, different kinds of thinking about melody, and
it's great.
So many variations.
I apologize to the non-musician who's listening, but that was a tremendously interesting and deep conversation, and you corrected me on something that I appreciate when I called it odd meters. You're right. It's only odd to the Western ear. It's not odd, of course, and why so many Western musicians, when they go into other cultures that are not using exclusively 2 and 3, they say this thing: I had trouble finding 1. You hear that a lot. You have trouble finding the downbeat because the meters are not obvious.
Whew, way over my head. It's as a so non-musician. Cool, though.
Yeah, very cool for our musical
but very interesting.
Fans.
I have a clip from Score that I want to play, and then I want to ask you. This is a clip from Junkie XL, Tom Holkenborg, in the film.
I don't care what music it is, but if I make a track, it has to give me goosebumps myself. I don't say that to be arrogant, but if it doesn't hit me in the stomach as being a great piece of music, I cannot expect the audience, anybody out there, to have a feeling that it hits the stomach.
So he wants to achieve the goosebumps. I think that's probably the goal of every composer. I guess the question is there a way to achieve goosebumps? I know we talked about the reward center and the way we feel when we get goosebumps can, you know, certain things can trigger that. But are most people getting goosebumps at the same time when something like that has happened? Is that just human culture, or are we drawing from personal connections? Is there any way to really explain that?
I think the closest would be there are studies on chills, so musical chills and feeling, for example, a spine tingling feeling. That's also related to goosebumps as well. There's a lot of research on that. A couple of things that have come from that research are we tend to feel chills in music when something happens, like a melody rises out of a harmonic pattern. So when we suddenly hear melody sort of rising up above a lot of music. But another thing has to do with surprise. So if there's something unexpected that happens in the music, that also can help us feel something grander. The other thing too is that people respond differently to the same piece of music. So there was a study in, I think it was in 2011, looking at how the same piece of music played with piano versus a small brass quintet, so 5 people playing brass versus an orchestra, how people respond differently in terms of how much they feel tension. And they found that people with musical training responded differently to people who didn't have musical training. They both were very sensitive to tension and emotion in music, which is very related to these goosebumps. But people who didn't have musical training tended to feel more of that with piano music, and those with musical training tended to feel more of that with orchestral music. They were both very sensitive, but they were sort of responding differently. So I think when we talk about music, we have to also think about how we talk about a score like it's one thing, but every listener is actually reacting in a slightly different way. We're all individual listeners. So what we bring in, whether it's music training or with our associations with the music, what our likes are and dislikes and our histories, we bring that in as well. So there are overall patterns, but there's a lot of individual difference.
You've just actually articulated one of the most difficult parts about scoring a film, and really for our audience of composers and film music fans, here you have a composer of a film who's very well trained, who's often, you know, the composers that we work with went to Juilliard, went to USC, went to NYU, went to Berklee College of Music. They know a lot about what they're doing, how to arrange and orchestrate and tempos and different kinds of patterns and harmonic progressions. And then you get a director that is non-musical, and you've just described what happens when the composer has a whole solution to something that's very thought out, and the director says, nah, I don't like it. and it hasn't reached him. It's a really interesting thing, because either the composer's missed it and overthought it, or the director doesn't see a certain subtlety that might work. I've been through that a number of times. Often I just tell the composer, play it for him again in a week. Maybe he'll like it more.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that, because repetition alone, just becoming more familiar with the music, can change the way that we hear that piece of music. I think it's so important to also remember that the everyday listener who doesn't have musical training, they can be extremely, extremely sensitive to music, and they can have insights into music and be very moved by it. I've learned so much from my students who don't have musical training but can tell me why a soundtrack is working for them. So one of the wonderful things about what the composers are able to do is they're able to reach all kinds of listeners. So the listener mm-hmm. who's coming in with a very different kind of background, they're able to move them, sort of paint with their musical paintbrush these colors that we can all see. They might be different colors, but there's a rainbow nonetheless. That's a special talent.
What you were talking about, how people react musically trained versus not. I'm curious, do you play any musical instruments?
Yes, my training, I was a music major, and my training was in piano. And so all the composing I did was at a piano, and I would not be able to do anything so elaborate or orchestrated as the musicians that we see on score. In fact, I took an orchestration class. There was only one assignment that we were given. So we came on the first day and they said, this is orchestration, and all you have to do is for these 10 weeks work on one piece and orchestrate it. So that means put that to lots of different instruments. And I did that for 10 weeks and I thought, oh, this is going to be great. We gave all the music to a orchestra, and I went and, you know, I had to conduct it. So I went to conduct it, and it sounded like cats drowning in like
which
in
some directors might want. You never know.
It's a very difficult thing to be able to put the right pieces, the right notes into the right instruments to play. It's a real skill.
Is it hard for you to watch anything? 'Cause with all the studies and the stuff that you know, and plus your musical training, are you able to just sit down and enjoy something, or are you picking stuff apart? Because as a filmmaker, I'm always watching for shots and style decisions by the you know, the crew putting the film or the show together. But do you watch differently than us, do you think?
No, I think I watch a movie and I just enjoy it for the movie. And if I have to sit and analyze it, I will analyze it. But usually I'm just watching as someone who's going to be carried away and lost in the movie. Only occasionally I think about the score, because I think mine's a little different from your training, Kenny, because music comes in and out, and we're often not aware of its presence. So sometimes I find myself, even if I'm trying to listen to the music, saying, oh, when did that start or when did that end? And I sit there in the dark as well, you know, like everyone else, and I look at all the pieces of music that are listed at the end, and I go, when was that playing? When was that playing? So, you know, I really think that I'm watching a film to be carried away by the story primarily, and then I can switch
modes. Relief.
Yeah.
Such a relief, because I thought that was a really great question. I was wondering what the answer was, because I was nervous that the answer would be different, because I'm the same way. And I saw, you know, and here both of us have spent, all of us spent so much time listening to film music. But the mark of any great film, of course, is that you are just so deeply involved in the narrative. I saw just a few nights ago, I saw the movie A Quiet Place, with a great score by Marco Beltrami. And I'd been told, the score's amazing, the score's amazing. And I found myself doing the same thing, which is so freaked out by the movie that occasionally I'd say, ooh, I think there was a cool piece of music in that scene. But I was so distracted by what was happening that I just heard the very end of the cue. And I thought the same thing. When did the music start in this scene? I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, it's so fascinating that we're not so aware of it, and yet it can have such a great impact. And it's interesting for me, Robert, to hear you say that, because, you know, you're a producer of hundreds and hundreds of movie scores. So to hear that you can just listen to it purely and watch a film purely is just fascinating for me to hear. The other day, my husband and I were watching The Wizard of Oz, the 3D version.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, and the 3D version, it's just fascinating to see this movie. And that's an example of, I was just swept away, even though it's a movie from many, many years ago, I was just swept away by the narrative.
I think one of the nice things about seeing a movie like The Wizard of Oz, or any movie that we've seen many times, is then we can start maybe distancing ourselves a little from the narrative, because you know what happens next.
Looking for some Easter eggs.
Yeah, and look secrets. For the way that things really take place in the movie, and how the composer made some decisions. And that I also enjoy. But the first time I see a film, I'm just a fan in the audience like anyone else.
Yeah.
Trying to see if the movie works. In fact, the only time I really hear the music in the movie is when it's bad.
Yeah, I was going to say this.
It sticks out
best,
as, wow, that's
the best
weird.
Movies and the best scores, you almost have to go back and listen, because they're done so well that they're specifically not supposed to stand out as something standalone. You want to sort of be whisked away into the into
absolutely.
The world. We are going to take one more break. And then when we come back, we had so many great questions sent in on our social media, Instagram and Twitter. We're going to ask Dr. Sulan Tan some of your questions. And we're also going to be giving away to one of the entries an autographed copy of Dr. Sulan's book, Psychology of Music, From Sound to Significance, the second edition. And she's going to autograph it and send it to the lucky winner. So much more to come. Stick around. We'll be right back. Hey guys, it's Kenny. We're back to the show in 20 seconds, but we wanted to quickly say thanks to all of you who've supported season one of Score the Podcast. One of the most important things you can do is click subscribe on your podcast app. It's free, it takes just a second, and it makes a huge difference in our growth. Thanks for your continued support. We're excited to bring you more great episodes in the future. Now back to the show. Welcome back. We're joined by Dr. Sulan Tan, all the way from Michigan. She's taking the time to come on the show and really break down some super interesting topics about the study of music and film music in particular. You remember her from Score, a film music documentary, and also her segments in season one, The Inside Track. We put out a little thing on our social media, if you're not following us, at Score the Podcast on Twitter. We wanted to ask you to ask questions for Dr. Sulan Tan. So we had several submissions on both Instagram and Twitter. And one of the lucky senders of a question, if you will, is going to win an autographed copy of your book, which is on our website, score-movie.com/podcast. But is it also on Amazon?
It's on Amazon, and it's published by Routledge. So it's on Routledge's page as well.
Cool. So we're going to announce the winner of the book in just a bit, but we want to get to some questions. Robert, you want to start it off?
Yeah. In fact, one of the nicest things about the questions is that they are from so far away.
All over the world.
Really, the whole world.
Awesome.
Australia, Switzerland, New York City. Here's the first one from Sarah Goddard in Australia. She wrote us on Twitter. Sulan, what is it about adding vocals that makes a score more emotional? I've noticed with some films like Gravity and Wreck-It Ralph that they bring in vocals for the really powerful emotional moments. So I guess she's wondering, Sulan, if you could comment on the emotional effect that a choir or a solo voice has on the listener. She says this must go back centuries. Probably to the first time somebody sang.
Yeah. Well, I really liked Sarah's question because usually I get asked questions about instruments and people forget that the voice is the most natural musical instrument. So I think it's a very interesting thing to think about voice and the power of the human voice in soundtracks. And Robert knows a whole lot more than me about songs with lyrics. So I'm just going to be focusing on just the voice separate from the lyrics and the meaning of the lyrics. So I've already mentioned how we are already hearing sound in the womb about 3 months before we're born. So the mother's voice is one of those sounds that is particularly internally transmitted into the womb. So it's one of the first contacts we have to our caregiver is through the sound of the voice, even before we're born. So it makes sense that there's something instinctive in us that makes human voice very powerful and very connecting. So when Sarah brings up Gravity is a great example because we have Sandra Bullock, who is completely cut off, completely isolated. And what brings her comfort is voice. So there are a couple of times where she's outside the capsule and she's humming to herself. It's a way of sort of feeling present, feeling her own body. And then there's a part where she's in the capsule, Soyuz capsule, I think, and she hears a voice being transmitted. And it's a male voice singing a lullaby to a baby, and it calms her. And then at the end, I'm trying to stay away from spoilers, but in the last 10 minutes...
We're probably good by now.
In the last 10 minutes, we've had Stephen Price's music. It's mainly instrumental. And then when we're supposed to start to feel a bit comforted, we hear voice coming in. A voice is added. And we hear that voice stronger and stronger towards the very end of the movie. So it kind of is so important in cutting through from the instrumental, which can be a little colder, to this warmth that's added that makes us feel like we're coming home. There's something just very grounding and comforting, warming about the human voice.
I love that. Oof. It's just so great. It is so wonderful. And now, of course, I want to rush home and watch Gravity
right?
again and listen to the way it develops.
Great question, Sarah.
Score.
Thanks for listening all the way in Australia. Let's go to question number two. This one is from Roberto Moreno in Zurich. Is that how you pronounce
Zurich.
It? Zurich. Mm-hmm. Switzerland. He wrote in on Twitter, and he wanted to more of just an interest in discussing moments when there's consciously no music at all, no score. For these scenes, he says, they have a greater impact on him. What is it about the decision to put nothing in there? And why does that have more of an impact on us? Is it the uncomfortable nature of feeling silence? How can that be explained?
Mm-hmm. So Roberta's question, I think, is really interesting because we're usually talking about scores, and now we're talking about the absence of music. So it's really important that music isn't wall-to-wall in a film because we can get habituated to it. That's the psychologist's terms for if we're exposed to something over and over and over again, we are attending less to it, we pay less and less and less attention to it until finally we've kind of faded it out from our attention. So if we have too much music, the music can lose some of its power. So that's important that there are some breaks. And I think Roberto does a good job of kind of answering his own question when he says that when the music isn't there, he listens more to the sounds that are inside the scene. And if you go back to that scene, the T-Rex breakout scene in Jurassic Park, something really important is happening there, and that is that it's happening in the rain. I think it's really important to think about the soundtrack not just as music alone, but it's how music and dialogue and sound effects work together as a whole for the most powerful effect. So that scene, the T-Rex breakout scene, is in the rain, and the water is something that's a constant sound. It doesn't change. We're not hearing the T-Rex roar against nothing. We're hearing it against the sound of the rain. And what's interesting about the sound of the rain is the rain is constant and it's not changing. So it's kind of like it doesn't care about the things that are happening in the scene. In Psycho, we have the same thing, falling water of the shower. So we hear the shower water, and then this horrible, terrifying murder happens. And then what do we hear? The sound of the shower. Still going on. So if we had music, like a musical score there, it might warm up the scene too much, or it might act like it's empathetic to what's happening, but instead we get indifference. So here's the sound of the rain or the sound of the shower, shh, and then something happens, and then shh, it just continues. Like it's indifferent. It's unempathetic to what's happening.
I actually am ready to book my ticket to Kalamazoo to take your course.
I know. I was going to say, are
so
you,
interesting.
Is your curriculum going to be used anywhere else at any point?
You mean my course syllabus?
Is this type of course being taught anywhere else around the country is my question.
Yeah, psychology of music classes are being taught around the world, actually. I don't know of many classes that are just looking at psychology of film music. I would love to see more and more of those. It's certainly a class that students are drawn to. They love this kind of topic.
Oh, I would love great. It. If you were teaching here in LA,
I'd be there.
I would go.
I
Absolutely.
Thought you were going to say one little bit about silence in film, in that the oldest trick in the book, for two reasons that I can think of, to go silent is, number one, there's nothing scarier. Mm-hmm. So when a bad guy's going up the stairs, instead of doing the trope of, you know, low notes or low cellos or low piano things that say, oh, here comes the bad guy, just go quiet, and the audience just you can watch from the back of the room, the audience clutches onto them, who's ever there with, whoever they are with, because when it's silent, you know something's going to happen. And that something's going to happen, the second part of silence is, it really accentuates the entrance of the music. So the music has import, which is what you were saying, which is when it's wall to wall, you don't get the benefit of, as they say, laying out for a little bit. So that when it comes back in, there's a feeling now. So silence is very important to music. Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, I love the way that you express that, and especially how isolating silence is, that we feel so alone.
I think coming back to that movie, A Quiet Place, one of the things that was amazing is the trope of silence in a movie is almost the focus of the narrative, which is, I don't want to be a spoiler, but the bad creatures only hear. And so you only have to be silent. I did just give the whole movie away. But so the score has to be very, very selective about where it's going to score music, because you're being almost conditioned in the first act of the movie to make no noise.
That was probably one of the most important spotting sessions in a movie long time.
Yeah, I was thinking about it.
It's so important to the narrative of the film.
So it's a really interesting thing. You want to go with that last question?
Oh, yeah, final question here.
From New York City.
Thanks again to Roberto for sending that in, all the way from
good.
Switzerland.
Yep.
This one is from Nate Huntley in New York City on Instagram. When scoring a film in a franchise, how does the theme continuity affect our experience? For example, a Marvel film using the same theme for a character or a motif, how can that affect us and draw us in a little bit and help us follow the story?
It's actually, Sulana, just to jump in here, it's actually a it's a very interesting issue with sequels at studios. I just can tell you from the studio point of view. Of course, the studio wants to do something that's very traditional in opera, the leitmotif, which is every time you see Robert Downey in Iron Man, you want to hear his theme. Every time you see Darth Vader, of course, you want to hear the march when he comes in. Or these themes are signals to audiences. It's almost like putting on the T-shirt that says, "Here I am." The studio really loves that. The composers, not surprisingly, don't. First of all, if you have a composer score, I don't want to refer to, you know, luckily, Pirates of the Caribbean, you get the same composer, Star Wars, you get the same composer, but on every different superhero movie, you don't always have the same composer
right.
from picture to picture. Even on Harry Potter, you had John Williams kick it off, and then Patrick Doyle inherits the next one. So you go to Patrick Doyle, who you want to do a fabulous original score, and say, good news, bad news. Good news is you're doing Harry Potter, and isn't it great? Bad news is some of your cues are going to be by the other guy. We need you to use the other guy's music. And the composer often says, but wait, I could be original, I can be expressive. Or the composer knows I have to use some of the similar material. So I don't know.
A little callback.
Yeah. I don't know, Nate, if this is sort of what you were wondering, but the continuity is important commercially and also narratively to the audience. And it's also can be an issue often in filmmaking, which is how much continuity and how much freshness for the sequels and prequels.
Well, and James Newton Howard talked about that a little bit in our third episode of season one, referring to doing Fantastic Beasts, but then having to call back to Harry Potter. That's even a different franchise altogether,
oh,
but it's
God,
it's in
right.
the same world, yep. so you have to call back to certain themes when characters come in. But is there anything psychologically that helps us follow or join in to what the composer's trying to do or the filmmaker's trying to do with keeping motifs in the story?
Yeah, I love your comments because I thought it was really interesting to hear Robert talking about how composers might react to this, might respond to this as creative people. In terms of the franchise and theme continuity, I think it's really, really important to the identity of the film, right? So the continuity is important. It kind of makes me think about right now I'm working on a book with two of my colleagues, James Diaville and Ron Rodman. We're working on the Oxford Handbook of Music and Advertising. And it's the same sort of thing in advertising where sonic logos, branding, audio branding of different companies is so important. So a franchise is the same sort of thing. You're trying to show that these things are all interlinked. And it's probably one way that, sonically at least, we can create this continuity from film to film and also from films to other media. So, for example, franchises that have a film that also have a video game, for example, and other kinds of media as well. And, of course, when you're doing video game composing, it's a very different kind of composing. You have to be able to compose things that could be layered and could be looped in ways mm-hmm. because there's a lot more repetition. And when you are a composer for film, you're kind of in charge of when the piece is going to begin and end and how it unrolls, how it unfolds. With a video game, you're not quite sure because it's based on what the player might be doing and where they're going, for example, and what they choose. So I think that it all comes down to, just to reiterate what both you, Robert, and Kenny have both said, identity and continuity between all of these different films.
It's like a commercial jingle when they start a new, you know,
you're right.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Immediately you're like, oh, that's McDonald's. They connect.
Mm-hmm. We are farmers. What's interesting is that I had to, for two decades, link the two worlds of sonic identification and filmmaking with arguably what's known as one of the most famous logos in the world. Audio logos. Keep going. So I wonder if we're going to have to pay a royalty.
You asked if he was going to sing. That was close enough.
I got
it.
So that was, you wanted to identify the motion picture, what studio, what was the brand, and that was very important. Of course, Walt Disney with When You Wish Upon a Star, this is audio
or
branding.
THX. You know you're in for an audio treat when you hear that noise back in the day.
People like it.
I think we have time for one more. I have another one that was sent in on Instagram.
Actually, can I add something very quickly to that last part?
Sure,
is that fine? Yeah, so when Robert was talking about the 20th Century Fox, it made me think about how important it is not just to have the continuity, but also as the times changed, the orchestration changed a little bit, the style of how that sonic signature was played was a little different. And I think that's really important, too, for franchises, that you hear the same motif, but things like the instrumentation, the things around it might change. So there's a little bit of variability as well.
Yeah, they've updated it.
This is an actual... this would be an episode in itself. The Fox logo and the re-recording, which was, there was very few people left standing alive after that conversation because it needed to be re-recorded. And I think we talk about it a little in...
I think Brian Tyler ended up he redid the Universal.
Universal
open,
was redone. And
but the motif is still there. The familiar sound,
but sensitivity.
The instrumentation and
a lot of sensitivity to how it's done. And in the Fox logo, there was luckily, let's just leave it at this. David Newman was of course, the composer, arranger, orchestrator who re-recorded his father's composition. So we all felt that genetically we were going to be safe. But it's a big issue for a studio if you change the logo, change the instrumentation. You either get, oh, that's fresh, or, oh, that's wrong.
Yeah, and once you change it, you can't do it again really quickly.
Yeah.
It's like similar with the big companies and their ad campaigns.
Yeah. Right.
They change something, you see flow on Progressive for 15 years before they change it again. But
yeah.
It's an interesting topic.
Right, and even when it comes to something like TV themes, that kind of variation is done. Bear McCreary talks about how in Walking Dead, the TV theme, he changes it a little bit every time. It's never exactly the same.
That's great.
So but you still have the identity, but the variations as well.
Isn't he brilliant?
He's
Bear,
great.
Brilliant.
Bear is just taking, he's just taking this...
Yep.
World by storm right
he
now.
He has, yep.
All right, that was a question from Nate in New York. Thanks, Nate. One last question from Xander. I don't know where Xander is from, but he sent in on Instagram. And we touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to give an opportunity to try and maybe answer this a little more detailed. How does different instrumentation change how people perceive a cue or a piece of music? For example, if the same piece of music, such as a romantic cue, is played with trombones versus a violin, how does that change how we feel when we hear it? And why does that maybe have that effect on us with the different instruments?
Yeah, the different instruments each have different timbres or different quality of the tone, and each one evokes something a little bit different. I think a great example is in Up from the Married Life montage. It's interesting because in the Married Life montage, we have ups and downs in this couple's life, right? There are happy and very sad, very, very sad moments. And a lot of composers would take the motif and change it from major to minor. That's an easy way of kind of, now it's sad, now it's happy. But if you listen to the Married Life montage, Giacchino never changes from major to minor. He's instead changing the speed, he's changing the style, he's changing many things, including the instruments, especially the instruments. So the instruments communicate to us what the emotions are in all of these episodes in this couple's life. So when we have the muted trumpet, I think it's a muted trumpet, towards the beginning, that evokes a certain period of time. This is like, okay, this is sentimental. This is a certain period of time in history. Then later on, when we hear the bell-like high tones, that's every time they're talking about having children and babies. So that gives a very different feeling. And then there's violins and strings for the waltz. And at the very end, you have the piano chord, just very plaintive piano chords at the end. So much is being communicated through the choice of the instruments.
I'm not a crier, but that's that married life scene. I have to walk out of the room for that.
Yeah.
Especially when it does slow down with the... I thought it was a xylophone. Is it? It's bells?
Oh, no. I said it was bell-like. I think you're right. It's a xylophone or a glockenspiel. Yeah.
Super nice question, too. Xander? Is that,
Xander,
because it
yeah.
really
Xander.
Makes me think about how, coming back to your orchestration example, the choice of the instrument is really choosing the voice for that particular melody. And do you want it? And the examples that were used... You could play a beautiful melody on violin and then play it on trombone, and it would sound maybe comic. And you don't want it to sound comic. You want it to be romantic and vice versa. So it's just that's a great composer will know what is the proper voice.
Yeah, and there are certain kinds of instruments that will evoke something more romantic, like Xander is saying. So, for example, strings. Strings, you can play the instrument so it will slide from one note to another. Ah, that kind of thing. Whereas a xylophone, you know, we were talking about glockenspiel and xylophone, you strike it and you just get one sound, and then one sound. So it sounds bouncier and happier. So you want to have this comic kind of a, you know, feeling that Xander's talking about. You have these kind of bouncy instruments might be more easy than a instrument that's very sensitive, like the violin, for example. So when you talk about the timbre, too, it's not just the musical instruments, but also voice. The other day, I was listening again to Raya Yarbrough singing for Outlander, the Sky Boat song. She has just the right timbre for that song in her vocal tone.
See, we're going to do another episode on singers and on pop songs because you've tiptoed into an interesting arena here with the particular vocalists and what makes a hit song. And there's a lot to that, which we're just heading into. But I think we're going to save it for the next episode.
Yeah, we'll have to do another. This has been so interesting and
super.
I hope everybody gets as much out of this as I did because I'm so fascinated. And now, again, when I jump into watching something, I'm going to be paying more attention to ventriloquism and where I'm watching on the screen. And my experience, I probably won't be paying attention to the narrative very much because now I'm going to be looking for all kinds of stuff.
And I know I want to go back and see Gravity.
Yep.
And Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm.
Psycho, I've seen a lot, but maybe I'll watch again. You mentioned a number of films. Up, I have some watching to do.
Well, I do want to thank all of our listeners for sending in these great questions. And I wish we could sit here. We don't want to take up too much more of Dr. Tan's time, but that was just a round of applause for our listeners for sending those in. And then we do want to announce now who's going to win the autographed book by Dr. Tan.
Nice.
Drum roll, please.
Fire away.
Congratulations to Sarah Goddard from Australia.
Oh, it's going down under.
The book is going down under. So we'll get in touch with Sarah and make sure that she gets that autographed book. Psychology of Music from Sound to Significance, second edition.
Rutledge published.
Find it on our website, score-movie.com/podcast, and also on Amazon or Rutledge.
And congratulations, Sarah. I'm really looking forward to signing this book for you. I'll write a personal note as well. And from my colleagues as well, my co-authors are Peter Fordrescher and Ram Hare. Congratulations. It's great. And thank you so much for these really interesting questions that you have all sent in and your listeners as well. Kenny and Robert, I really enjoyed this. This was so much fun.
Same.
I've learned so much from the podcast, I have to say.
Oh, well, thank you. And we want to thank you for listening to the show. We're excited to, as we mentioned earlier, that season two is coming back. More info on that. Be sure to follow us on our social media account, Twitter at Score the Podcast, Instagram at Score Movie. We'll keep you posted on the details as they develop. We want to thank again Dr. Tan for taking the time to join us. We hope you stay warm in Michigan.
Stay warm.
And have a happy new year.
Thank you so much, Kenny. Thank you, Robert. What a pleasure this was.
I'm Robert Kraft. That's Kenny Holmes you've been listening to.
That's true.
Special shout out to Sulan, and we'll see you next time.